Welcome and thank you for joining this Ropes & Gray teleconference. My name is Teresa and I will be the operator for today's call. Today's teleconference topic is Outlook 2017, Enforcement Trends and the New Administration. And now I'd like to turn the call over to Alex Renee, partner in the Government Enforcement Group at Ropes & Gray.
Thanks, Teresa. Hello, and thank you, everyone, for joining the teleconference this afternoon. As Teresa mentioned, my name is Alex Renee. I'm a partner in the Government Enforcement Practice Group here in Washington, D.C. Today, we'll be discussing Trump's administration's impact on government enforcement matters, including any corruption, trade sanctions, and health care. I'm joined in today's discussion by two of my colleagues here in D.C., my partner, Colleen Connery, who also served as former chair of the Government Enforcement Practice Group, and Mike Casey, who's counsel in the D.C. office. The Trump administration is less than a week old, and there's still a lot of uncertainty. There's, of course, no way to predict the future here, but today we'll make our best predictions on what we'll see in the enforcement space based on what we know already. We plan to save time at the end to address any questions from our listeners. If you have questions during the teleconference, please email them to rgevents@ropesgray.com, and we will try to get to as many questions as we can. So, turning to Colleen, big picture, what do you think we can expect from the Trump administration in terms of enforcement?
So, you know, I think some people assume the Trump administration may go easy on corporate crime. And listen, there's still a lot of uncertainty about his positions. But we think there's good reason to expect that his administration will continue to be active in the white-collar space. So let's look to Jeff Sessions first, right, the nominee for Attorney General. He's really going to set the tone at the Department of Justice. He is a seasoned, old-school prosecutor, and he's taken tough stance on crime historically. He's a former United States attorney in Alabama and also served as the Attorney General for the state of Alabama. He spoke historically about being tough on crime and the S&L crisis, about how long prison terms deter misconduct. So I think, you know, I don't see him changing his stripes on that. During his confirmation hearing, he actually said that in some cases he thinks individual prosecutions can be more appropriate than blanket penalties for the business. So that to me suggests that a Sessions DOJ may continue to draw on the principles for individual prosecutions laid out in the Yates memo from the Obama administration, which looked to turn up the heat on individuals in corporate cases.
All right, so let's get into some specifics and key areas. Let's start with the anti-corruption world. Anti-corruption concerns are on many of our clients' radars. We've been hearing that consistently. The Bush and Obama administration made the FCPA priority, and fines and prosecutions, you know, they continue to grow during both administrations. Colleen, let me ask you this, since you served both in the civil and criminal divisions at Maine Justice, and now you do a heck of a lot of anti-corruption work, how do you think President Trump's election will impact FCPA enforcement?
You know, it's interesting. In general, the FCPA was not a major focus of Trump's campaign and has not been a focus in the transition. So we have to look back to 2012 when Trump went on the record saying he didn't like the FCPA. Trump told CNBC that he thought the U.S. is absolutely crazy to prosecute FCPA violations. He called the FCPA a horrible law and said it should be changed because it puts American businesses at a huge disadvantage. So just let's step back. Those comments are consistent with his campaign's focus on increasing the competitiveness of American businesses to restore jobs. But I think it's really important to keep in mind those remarks were made years ago about the potential prosecution of Walmart. And let's remember this, that's an iconic American-based company, not a foreign-based company like those that are the subject of so many FCPA prosecutions. So when you step back, you'll see that many of the largest FCPA penalties have been levied against foreign companies, including Siemens from Germany, Alstom, the French company, the British company BAE, and the Brazilian company Odebrecht. So the Trump administration may actually see the FCPA as a tool to be used against foreign interests in order to level the playing field for American companies.
All right, so let's shift gears a little bit now and talk a little bit more about President Trump's recent pick to head the DOJ and SEC. Let's start with Trump's pick for Attorney General, Senator Jeff Sessions. How do you think that Sessions is going to approach the FCPA?
Well, you know, as I said, he was a U.S. Attorney in Alabama, Alabama State Attorney General, so he's generally tough on crime. In his recent confirmation hearing, he focused on his civil rights record, immigration, and other issues. He hasn't said much on FCPA. But in the past, Sessions has questioned DOJ officials on whether there have been studies on the impact of the FCPA on the competitiveness of American businesses. That may suggest Sessions shares Trump's concern that aggressive FCPA enforcement may harm American interests. But again, the largest resolutions have involved foreign companies who have been using the capital markets in the U.S., so it's really hard to navigate that. It's also interesting that Sessions has questioned the use of deferred prosecution agreements, or DPAs, in this area, because they keep courts from considering the merits of DOJ's arguments. So, you know, this simply may be a function of his dislike of DPAs in general, which he's raised in other contexts. But even if you credit those comments, what that would mean is you simply see more cases going to trial or taking a criminal plea. So I think, you know, it's a wash in the end on that front.
All right. So, Mike, let's Colleen and I don't want to dominate this conversation. So what are your thoughts on Sessions and how he might approach some of these issues?
Yeah, it's a good question. And during the last few months, there have been some interesting parallels drawn between Sessions and John Ashcroft, the person who served as Attorney General during the George W. Bush administration. Before his confirmation, Ashcroft was widely considered to be pro-business. But once he became Attorney General, he ended up taking a very hard line on white-collar crime. Perhaps the most important and well-known case that the DOJ brought during his tenure was the indictment of Arthur Andersen, which was a big case and actually ended up putting Arthur Andersen out of business after it was found guilty of violating federal law. And in addition, as both of you have alluded to, Ashcroft really started an era of very aggressive enforcement of the FCPA. And that trend, as we've seen, continued through the Obama administration as well. So, like Ashcroft, Sessions has a very, very conservative reputation and is widely considered to hold pro-business views. But just because he has that reputation and those views doesn't mean he's necessarily going to go soft on crime and is not going to continue to pursue violators of financial crimes.
All right. So let me ask you this, Colleen. The DOJ has worked really hard to get companies to consider coming in, and the FCPA pilot program was a big part of that, and it's something they've touted quite a bit. What are your thoughts on how Sessions might approach the FCPA pilot program?
Sure. Well, it's interesting. He hasn't discussed the pilot program publicly or specifically, but in other contexts, he's shown support for giving companies full credit for self-reporting, which is a key component to the pilot program. So he may be open to continuing to invite self-reporting and cooperation going forward.
Well, Trump tapped Jay Clayton, M&A lawyer from New York, to lead the SEC. He's reportedly been, you know, critical of the FCPA in the past. What do you think of him?
Sure. So this derives from Clayton's stint as the head of the Business Transactions Committee of the New York City Bar Association. That committee issued a report in 2011 that suggested that aggressive FCPA enforcement puts an unfair cost on U.S. businesses and may not actually decrease corruption. It also focused a bit on the foreign companies who are availing themselves of the U.S. capital markets. But it's important to remember that report was published in 2011, right, nearly 6 years ago, and some of the report's concerns have been partially alleviated by the fact that both the U.S. and foreign anti-corruption efforts have been hitting foreign companies hard as well.
Yeah, I think that's right. I agree. We've seen in recent years that many of the high-profile FCPA matters have involved foreign companies admitting wrongdoing in the United States and paying big fines to the U.S. government. In addition, we've seen anti-corruption enforcement increase throughout the world. When the Business Transactions Committee report was published in 2011, the U.S. was really the only country that was actively enforcing anti-corruption laws. Since that time, other countries have implemented wide-ranging anti-corruption laws and have started to enforce them. So, for example, in the United Kingdom, there's the UK Bribery Act, which was enacted in 2010. And in the last 2 or 3 years, the Serious Fraud Office has become very active in bringing anti-corruption cases.
So let's talk a little bit about the Trump administration's other enforcement priorities, starting with DOJ. How might the fight for resources in the department affect FCPA enforcement?
I mean, that's interesting, right, because just recently Trump put into place a hiring freeze across the board in federal agencies, including the Department of Justice. But countering that is, you know, people in those agencies saw this coming, and there was a hiring frenzy at many of the department's subcomponents. And so to me, for the next year or two, that's probably about a wash on the terms of overall resources. But, Mike, what do you think about that issue?
Yeah, I think that's right. And I guess one other issue that I would point out is that in the last couple of weeks, Wei Chen, DOJ's compliance czar, who really has had primary responsibility for analyzing companies' FCPA compliance programs, just had her contract renewed for another 2 years. So she's staying on board, and I think a lot of people view that as a continued commitment by the DOJ to prosecute FCPA cases. Another couple points that are worth mentioning here is that, first, investigating and prosecuting FCPA cases isn't necessarily an expensive endeavor for the government. The majority of the DOJ's FCPA cases involve corporations conducting their own internal investigations and then self-reporting potential violations to the government. As a result of this model, the cost of these investigations really falls primarily on the companies and not the DOJ. And in addition, FCPA cases have really generated a lot of revenue for the DOJ and the federal government more generally during the last few years. You know, looking back just at the last year alone, federal government collected about $1 billion in FCPA cases. So it's you could say it's a profit center for the federal government.
Right, and I, you know, Mike, to that point, I think that's so important in this administration, you know, run by businessmen. You know, that return on investment, I think, really might be the overarching theme we see going forward.
We spent a lot of time right talking about DOJ. Let's focus a little bit on the SEC. What are your thoughts on how the SEC's priorities might fit with the FCPA?
Sure. So when Trump announced that he picked Clayton as chair, Trump talked about creating jobs while playing by the rules at the same time. Clayton also issued a statement right after that saying his main goal was creating jobs. So we all have to figure out the calculus of balancing creating jobs with playing by the rules and how that's going to play out. But the consensus view seems to be that Clayton will be more business friendly on the whole.
Yeah, you know, and honestly, I think I agree with that. You know, when we think back to Mary Jo White and how she made FCPA enforcement a top priority, which is something she often repeated in public statement, might not see this same aggressiveness from Clayton. But that, of course, leaves DOJ, which I think will continue to be very, very active in this area. Any other thoughts on the FCPA before we move on to sanctions? Mike's favorite topic.
Sure. So with any administration change, there's likely to be a shift in emphasis, right? But we may see a shift in how investigations are resolved, maybe with fewer DPAs. But I just don't see any abrupt changes in enforcement levels, especially from DOJ. And I think companies still need to be vigilant on these issues. And stepping back for a minute, when you think of self-reporting by companies, all of their staff must, under Sarbanes-Oxley, certify that they have no knowledge of fraud, right? And so that's still, if you know of bribery in foreign countries, no, you know, accountant or controller is going to sign off if they don't know of fraud if they actually do. So I think once that's raised within the company, it's raised to the auditors, all the impetus to self-report, you know, comes to the top. So I still think self-reporting is going to be large. And I think enforcement by other countries on U.S. companies also is going to drive the SEC and DOJ to take action.
So basically what you're saying, this isn't the time we don't need to worry about the FCPA, right, anymore.
Exactly.
All right. Let's shift over to sort of sanctions and international risk. Given President Trump's focus on putting America first, everyone's wondering how his administration will treat existing sanctions with, you know, Iran and Russia and Cuba. Starting with Iran sanctions, in 2016, the U.S. and EU lifted some non-proliferation sanctions against Iran as part of its obligations under the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, or the JCPOA. Mike, again, right in your wheelhouse. How do you expect the situation with Iran will look under a Trump administration?
I think it's hard to say. You know, President Trump has been very critical of President Obama's approach towards Iran and the JCPOA. You know, in the last week or so, he said that he considered the JCPOA to be, quote, one of the worst deals ever, end quote. And he also called it, this is another quote, a, quote, stupid, lopsided disgrace. So not a ton of enthusiasm from President Trump about the JCPOA. As president, he will have the authority to pull the United States out of the JCPOA. He can unilaterally end our involvement in that framework agreement if he so chooses, but he might not actually do so. The U.S. did not negotiate the JCPOA alone, but rather negotiated alongside five other countries, all of those countries seem to want that framework to continue. Given that context, I think really the more likely outcome here would be for Mr. Trump to undo certain aspects of the sanctions relief that the U.S. has provided to Iran in connection with the JCPOA. So, for example, we could see his administration revoke General License H, which is an OFAC general license that allows foreign subsidiaries of U.S. companies to do business in Iran. Taking this step would be a big deal for a lot of foreign entities that have taken advantage of this general license during the last year. We've seen a lot of foreign subsidiaries of U.S. companies and foreign portfolio companies owned or controlled by U.S.-based private equity sponsors spend a lot of time and money developing relationships with Iranian counterparties, establishing policies and procedures to comply with the U.S. sanctions on Iran, and some of them have even gone so far as to make capital investments in Iran.
So, Mike, President Trump could also accuse Iran of violating its obligations under the deal, right? I mean, I believe he said at one point that he policed that contract so tough that, you know, they didn't have a chance, if memory serves correct. And violations by Iran could result in the so-called snapback, right, of U.S. sanctions that were in place before January 2015.
Yep, all of that is right. And I think most commentators think the Obama administration chose not to take a particularly hard line in monitoring Iran's compliance with the JCPOA over the last year. So, for example, the IAEA went into Iran last year, found that Iran held more heavy water than it was supposed to under the terms of the agreement, and the Obama administration offered to buy Iran's excess capacity of heavy water so that Iran could get into compliance with its obligations under the JCPOA. Another notable example occurred when the Obama administration took the position that Iran did not violate the terms of the JCPOA when it engaged in ballistic missile testing last year. So, based on what President Trump has said so far, I think it's fair to assume that the Trump administration is going to be less generous in assessing Iran's compliance with the JCPOA on a going-forward basis. If the United States finds Iran has violated its obligations, the U.S. could then snap back some of the sanctions that were previously in place before 2016.
What about Russia? The U.S. and the EU have imposed sanctions on Russia that could be lifted under this new administration. Just to recap recent activity, in March 2014, after Russia invaded the Ukraine, the U.S. and the EU imposed sanctions on certain individuals and President Putin's inner circle, as well as sectoral sanctions on Russian financial institutions, defense companies, and oil and gas companies. Then in mid-December of 2016, the EU extended its sanctions against Russia for six more months due to Russia's alleged failure to comply with the Minsk agreements. And in late December, President Obama imposed additional targeted sanctions in response to allegations of Russian hacking activity during the U.S. elections. Mike, what do you think? I mean, there's a whole lot to take into consideration there. And what do you see happening as a result of where the recent developments?
Yeah, if I had to guess, I would say that I think that the list-based sanctions, so the sanctions that are targeting high-level Russian government officials and other members of Putin's inner circle, as well as the Russians that engaged in hacking last fall, would continue to remain in place. I just think it would be too difficult for President Trump politically to remove those sanctions in light of everything that's happened, as well as his alleged connections with the Russian government. So I expect those to remain in place. I don't feel the same way about the sectoral sanctions. I think the most likely thing we're going to see in 2017 is that the United States is going to end its sectoral sanctions program. And I really think that for a couple different reasons. First, the EU sectoral sanctions targeting Russia are scheduled to expire in July. In order for those sanctions to continue past July, all 28 members of the EU would need to vote in favor of renewal. And I think that it's unlikely at this point. A number of European countries have expressed an interest in normalizing relations with Russia because of their commercial interests in that country. To date, the U.S. and the EU have moved in lockstep when it comes to sectoral sanctions. So if the EU terminates its sectoral sanctions, then I think it's more likely the U.S. will as well. Another reason why I think sectoral sanctions program is likely to end is that Mr. Trump has said, you know, time and again that he's looking for a reset in relations with Russia. Lifting the sectoral sanctions would be a clear signal that the Trump administration is going to take a different approach to Russia than the Obama administration did. And I think politically it would be easier for him to lift those sanctions, which aren't as popular as the list-based sanctions.
So, Mike, what sort of impact do you think Rick Tillerson, Mr. Trump's appointee for Secretary of State, what impact do you think he might have on U.S.-Russian relations?
Again, it's a fascinating situation we have here because no American company was hurt more by the imposition of sectoral sanctions than ExxonMobil. When the sectoral sanctions were introduced, Exxon was working with the Russian oil company Rosneft on a variety of oil-related projects in Russia, including drilling projects in the Arctic Ocean. Shortly after making an oil discovery in the Arctic as part of that project, Exxon was required to pull out of it in order to comply with the sectoral sanctions. While these events were unfolding, Tillerson served as the CEO of Exxon, and at the time he told shareholders that Exxon generally did not support sanctions because Exxon didn't think they were effective in moving forward the U.S.'s foreign policy objectives. So to the extent his past experiences impact his prospective view of sanctions, I think he's likely to advocate for lifting at least the sectoral sanctions targeting Russia and possibly other sanctions.
Isn't it true that Trump is facing some opposition in Congress from Republicans that believe sanctions against Russia, are overdue and important? House Speaker Paul Ryan, for example, believes sanctions are appropriate after 8 years of failed policy with Russia under the Obama administration. And Senator John McCain and Lindsey Graham have called for even stronger sanctions against Russia. So how do you see the interplay between, you know, Congress and Secretary of State and President Obama?
It's a great point you make. You have the Speaker of the House, Paul Ryan, saying he doesn't know what Trump's strategy with Russia is going to be, but he thinks the administration should take a hard line, which is an unusual posture. We also saw during Rex Tillerson's hearings that some of the most pointed questions asked to him about Russia didn't come from Democratic senators. They came from members of his own party, guys like Marco Rubio and Lindsey Graham and John McCain. So we very well might see some daylight between President Trump's view of Russia and Congress's view of Russia. And if so, we're just going to have to wait and see how that dynamic shakes out.
Let's turn to Cuba now. The Obama administration has reversed a policy that was in place for, you know, the last 50 years and has taken steps and had taken steps to relax the Cuban embargo. In the last weeks in office, President Obama was signing accords with Cuba to govern issues like territorial water limits, bird flu protocols, and search and rescue agreements. Mike, again, let me ask you, what might we see from a Trump administration with regards to Cuba?
Yeah, and a little bit of a consistent theme is developing here. We've seen both on the campaign trail and since he's taken office, President Trump be very critical of President Obama's foreign policy, and Cuba is no exception. So Trump has pledged to reverse President Obama's executive orders relating to Cuba, especially those executive orders that relaxed sanctions targeting Cuba. And several of his top appointees, including his national security advisor, Michael Flynn, have come out and said that they are opposed to normalizing relations with Cuba. So I think the most likely outcome we're going to see is a tightening back up of sanctions on Cuba. And if we see that, it's really going to have a negative impact on a number of U.S. companies that have started engaging with Cuba and have taken advantage of the relaxation of the sanctions to do new business in that country.
Is it that easy to reverse the executive orders that President Obama had put in place?
It is. So most of the sanctions relief that we saw during the Obama administration, in fact, all of it, came in the form of executive orders. So now that President Trump is president, he can undo those executive orders by issuing his own. So he really does have a lot of discretion in this area.
What can you tell me about, or tell us about, the incoming Secretary of State's views on Cuba?
Yeah, so unlike Russia, he doesn't seem to have the same sort of personal history involving Cuba. During his confirmation hearings, he said he would advise President Trump to veto any congressional bills that were designed to lift the Cuban embargo in its entirety. That doesn't seem like a realistic possibility for a variety of reasons, so I'm not sure how much that can tell us about his positions. He also said, in some ways, made an admission that he just needed to learn more about Cuba before he was able to articulate a more definitive policy.
Now, a hallmark of Trump's presidential campaign was his criticism of foreign governments and foreign companies' involvement in the U.S. economy. Now that he's been elected, do you foresee, Mike, him trying to address those issues from a regulatory perspective?
He certainly will have that option. And one trend that we've seen over the last decade or so has been the U.S. government increasingly scrutinizing foreign investment in the United States through something called the CFIUS review process. And CFIUS is an interagency government committee that has the authority to review transactions that could result in a foreign person, and foreign person is defined to include foreign governments, foreign companies, and foreign individual investors, obtaining control of the U.S. business. So most people expect today that CFIUS is going to become more aggressive in the future in reviewing and potentially blocking foreign investment in the United States.
So you say most people feel that there's going to be an increase in that. I mean, have you seen any signs from President Trump or Congress that they actually will go down that road into strengthening CFIUS?
Yeah, so a number of members of Congress have advocated that CFIUS be granted increased authority to review foreign transactions. Those Congress people don't think that CFIUS has the power it needs to effectively deal with the various threats to national security and potentially even the U.S. economy that come along with foreign investment. In addition, late last year, a group of representatives asked the GAO to conduct an assessment of CFIUS to examine whether CFIUS, in fact, has adequate authority to review foreign investment in the United States. The GOA is scheduled to begin that examination later that month, and depending on the findings of that review, it could give Congress either the power or the fig leaf, depending on how you want to look at it, to increase the scope of CFIUS's jurisdiction and power.
President Trump frequently criticized foreign investment during his campaign. Any other signs that tell us how he might approach foreign investment during his administration?
Yeah, I mean, one of the platforms of Trump's campaign was that he's not a strong proponent of free trade. He thinks it's hurt U.S. economy. He thinks it's hurt U.S. companies. He thinks it's hurt U.S. workers. And we've seen that play out already. One of his first actions after assuming office was to formally withdraw the United States from the Trans-Pacific Partnership. He also has said in the last week or so that he intends to renegotiate NAFTA and to increase tariffs on imports entering in the United States. So I think when you take it all together, we're left with the feeling that it's going to be more difficult for foreign investors to make investments in the United States and to bring products into the United States too.
All right. So with that, I'd like to shift gears a bit and talk a little bit about healthcare enforcement. Colleen, going back to you now, you've handled a number of healthcare enforcement cases and have seen the inner workings of both of the Civil Division Fraud Section and Criminal Division Fraud Section of Maine Justice. What do you expect to see under a Trump administration in the healthcare space?
So historically, administration changes don't dramatically cause a shift in healthcare or False Claims Act enforcement. For one thing, it's just good politics to fight Medicare fraud, and that applies across both sides of the aisle. Taking on this fraud cuts back on both corporate abuse and wasteful government spending at the same time. Also, many healthcare cases are driven by attorneys in the career ranks, not presidential appointees, and most of these career prosecutors will remain in place administration to administration. And I think probably most importantly, most False Claims Act cases are brought in the first instance by private whistleblowers, and there's no sign that they'll be going away anytime in the near future.
So do you see any changes coming down the line?
I do see some changes, but they're really at the margins. I fully expect that the change in leadership at DOJ will mean a shifting of priorities and perhaps funding. My best guess is that we'll see DOJ take a slightly more business-friendly view in some of the gray areas, like off-label promotion. That's been a hot topic in recent years.
Let's talk a little bit about Jeff Sessions, back to Mr. Sessions. What do you think his approach will be as it relates to healthcare enforcement?
So Sessions has about a 15-year period of experience as a prosecutor, both at the state and federal levels. During his time in the Senate, he also referred back to this experience in the trenches and his desire to be aggressive on crime. He's made comments over the years that suggest that he'll bring that approach to the healthcare space. For example, in the past, Sessions has said that combating healthcare fraud is an important issue and emphasized that it takes sustained effort and support from the top of DOJ to fight it effectively. In his confirmation hearings, Sessions said outright that he'll continue to prioritize fraud enforcement under the FCA. He emphasized that the federal government can't afford to lose a single dollar to fraud and abuse. So I don't expect to see him looking to dramatically roll back healthcare enforcement.
I mean, that really does make a lot of sense. And if Sessions prioritizes the issues he's talked about recently, you know, national security, immigration, things like that, then maybe he won't put as much effort into changing DOJ's current course on healthcare enforcement.
That's right. And as you say, I both know from our own experience, career lawyers at DOJ make an effort to stay consistent across administrations. Many attorneys spend years at the Department of Justice and outlast attorneys general. Key decision-making roles will continue to be held by career people. So let's look at Joyce Branda. She currently heads the Commercial Litigation Branch, which includes the civil fraud section and is ultimately responsible for FCA cases. Joyce has been working on False Claims Act matters in the government for 30 years. Now, obviously, there's going to come a time when Joyce will step down and out of that role, but my best guess is there will be somebody like her that steps in and fills her shoes. Also, many healthcare fraud cases come out of U.S. attorney's offices across the country, and they'll likely keep doing what they've been doing in healthcare enforcement. Let's look at the U.S. Attorney's Office in Boston as an example. It's one of the leading offices on healthcare enforcement. We're reading in the press, and many of the names floated, I won't go into them here, but many of those names being mentioned are former Assistant United States Attorneys who were involved in white-collar crime, including healthcare matters. So we don't expect much is going to change in healthcare enforcement.
So let's talk a little bit about, I mean, back to DOJ and Sessions specifically. We know who might be filling some of the top spots within the department. I know you said you weren't going to talk about some of the others, but we're going to talk about some. And we know that Sessions is looking to Rod Rothstein as his deputy attorney general. What do you make of that?
So to me, that's really telling that Sessions is looking to Rod Rosenstein. Rod is a well-respected, serving prosecutor, and he's served on both sides of the aisle. He's actually the longest-serving U.S. attorney in the department. He's been the Baltimore U.S. attorney since 2005, serving under both Bush and Obama. And before that, he was in the tax division at DOJ. To me, that all means Rod's going to appreciate the complexity of regulations businesses face, especially in the healthcare space, and will want to give them a fair shake. But it also means he's not afraid to bring a complicated enforcement case, be it healthcare or FCPA. And if you look at what we call the beachhead appointments at DOJ, just below the Senate-confirmed leadership, so immediately below Rod, it sounds like there's going to be another former Baltimore U.S. attorney who worked closely with Rod, James Kroll. James is another veteran AUSA who has worked at Maine Justice. He's got a lot of experience prosecuting public corruption. One of the biggest cases that he brought was a bribery case against a Maryland politician. He also has experience prosecuting government contract fraud. So again, my best guess is that these DOJ picks are not going to shy away from bringing white-collar cases, be it FCPA or FCA. And Kroll, like Sessions, is certainly not afraid to make a case against individuals.
So what I hear you saying is that conservative leadership at DOJ doesn't mean less healthcare enforcement.
I think that's right, and we can look to history to make that point. Earlier, we compared Sessions to Attorney General John Ashcroft. Under Ashcroft, healthcare fraud recovery topped $1 billion for the first time in history. His DOJ then kept up that high level of enforcement throughout the Bush administration.
So let's talk a little bit more about resources and funding. Starting this month, Republicans control the White House and both houses of Congress. Small government conservatives could succeed in instituting budget cuts. And in addition to its insurance provisions, the Affordable Care Act also dedicated resources to FCA enforcement. How do you think these changes might impact healthcare enforcement?
The funding issue is a really interesting one, Alex. It just speaks to why the FCA activity stays so consistent across administrations. The False Claims Act, at its core, is a moneymaker for the federal government. In 2016, the government collected more than $4.7 billion from FCA cases. That makes 2016 the fifth year in a row the government's brought in over $3.5 billion. And if you look at the total dollars collected, a large chunk comes from healthcare fraud cases. In 2016, $2.5 billion came from healthcare. So So one way the False Claims Act cases are unusual is many of them get their start from key TAM relators. So these are private whistleblowers, and there's minimal government involvement at the inception of those matters. Just to put some numbers around it, of the 448 healthcare FCA actions brought in 2015, only 25 of those were initiated by the government rather than a whistleblower. And last year, 2016, 702 new FCA cases were brought just by whistleblowers. Now, FCA cases tend to be much more successful when the government does intervene, and maybe it's because the feds are good at picking the winners. But it also could be that the resources DOJ brings to bear make a difference. So, backing up, you know, to the extent there are fewer resources at DOJ devoted to healthcare enforcement, that may have an effect on FCA outcomes, but you'll still have private relators bringing suits. These whistleblowers are the real engine driving FCA recoveries.
Is there any concern that a Trump Sessions administration may try to put some sort of limits on FCA whistleblowers?
Now listen, that's certainly possible, and the president has made noises in that direction on Dodd-Frank, but we haven't heard that kind of talk in the False Claims Act space. And Sessions, interestingly, has said himself that whistleblowers can be a critical part of discovering frauds, and he thinks they're a legitimate part of our enforcement effort.
And the department has also been proactively bringing on its own cases, isn't that right?
Absolutely. This past August, the DOJ settled a $7.4 million FCA case against a group of doctors who were allegedly performing unnecessary screening procedures. One of the really interesting things about this case is that the DOJ discovered the alleged fraud through data analytics. When the DOJ looked at all the numbers, those doctors were statistical outliers. This type of analysis allows the department to efficiently identify and investigate frauds, and it can do so proactively. It doesn't have to wait for a whistleblower to bring the case.
So over time, though, do you think we may see the Trump administration take more conservative stances on enforcement just generally?
Yeah, we may see some subtle changes on the margins, and some of these changes could be favorable for businesses. But, you know, Sessions has expressed concern before about penalizing business behavior that does not involve affirmative bad intent. For example, Sessions has expressed concern that doctors and hospitals are worried about being prosecuted criminally for honest billing mistakes. But he still said billing mistakes should be pursued civilly and administratively, so it's not a total free pass on that. During his confirmation hearing, Sessions also expressed concern about the long time that many of the FCA whistleblower cases remain under seal. He said that this delay is a disadvantage to the defendants. So we may see Sessions work to get FCA cases moving more quickly and limit the time that an FCA case can remain sealed.
Any final thoughts, Colleen, on what we should expect from the Trump administration on healthcare enforcement?
So no one knows for sure what his administration will bring. But my best guess is, in the gray areas of complex regulation, Sessions may be less eager than Attorney General Holder or Lynch to push the envelope. So in off-label cases, for example, where companies provide truthful, non-misleading information about unapproved uses for their products, DOJ may be less likely to pursue the aggressive stances that have been rejected by the courts in Coronia and Emeryn. DOJ might dial back their positions a bit. But on fraud and abuse, as I talked before, I expect full steam ahead from them. So there are going to be some changes to the DOJ for sure, but for now I think we can expect healthcare fraud enforcement to stay relatively close to historical levels.
That's great. Thanks so much, Colleen and Mike. We have a question, and I think, Mike, this again is in your wheelhouse. Do you want to read the question and provide your response?
Sure. So let me read the question first. I have a question regarding sanctions against Iran. Suppose President Trump holds that Iran has violated the JCPOA. Can it unilaterally use the snapback mechanism, or would it require the consent of the P5+1? I understand that the U.S. can impose unilateral sanctions on Iran, but could the U.S. unilaterally trigger the snapback mechanism, thus forcing the UN and EU to impose sanctions on Iran? So the short answer to that is no. The United States by itself could not force the EU, the UN, or any of the five permanent members of the Security Council to impose sanctions on Iran. If the United States wanted to, it could file a complaint. There's a mechanism in the JCPOA where the parties to the agreement can allege another party to the agreement violated the terms of the agreement. If so, then that complaint would be adjudicated by a committee established by the JCPOA, and then the parties could take whatever action they feel is necessary in light of that decision. the reality is the United States, the other five members of the P5 plus one, and Iran are all independent states, and they can do what they want. So if the U.S. wants to reimpose sanctions that were pulled back as a result of the JCPOA, it can do that, and there's no real enforcement mechanism. Similarly, if the EU and the UN wanted to continue the sanctions relief it had granted to the UN, there's no way the U.S. could force them to do so.
Thanks, Mike. We received another question regarding whether or not we can read into Preet Bharara staying on and Sally Yates remaining on right now, and the U.S. attorneys right now also being able to keep their posts. Is that, Colleen, I'll ask you, is there anything we should read into that?
You know, it is interesting to me, particularly Sally Yates, that rather than having a career Republican-based attorney or designee assume the acting AG position, he's asked Sally Yates to stay on. It's an interesting move and shows some sign of trust, in my view. But I think the more interesting move is asking Preet Bharara to stay on as United States Attorney for the Southern District of New York, right? We all know the Southern District is the most important district in terms of regulating financial crimes and financial services industry. And so asking him, Preet historically was tremendously aggressive in pursuing financial crimes, particularly insider trading. And so the notion that was one of the Trump administration's first moves was to ask Preet to stay on, I think it's just a general sign, a data point, that enforcement is going to continue, you know, especially in the financial services industry. So interesting across the board.
Thanks, Colleen. Thanks, Mike. That's all the time we have. I want to thank everyone for joining us today. And again, thank Colleen and Mike for many of their insights. For additional news and analysis about the regulatory and enforcement issues emerging from the federal government, I invite you to visit our recently launched Capital Insights page at www.ropesgray.com. Thank you very much.
Thank you, ladies and gentlemen, for your participation. You may now disconnect.